And Chico Freeman, tenor saxophonist and composer, is with me now live in the studio. He's from Chicago, and his father, by the way, is tenor saxophonist Von Freeman, who's very legendary amongst jazz listeners, but he's made few recordings and really never left Chicago. Chico Freeman now lives in New York. He studied music in Chicago. He studied with Mool Richard Abrams at the AACM, which is the acronym for the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians. It's a musician-run arts group in Chicago, and in 78 he received an M.A. in Composition and Performance from Governor State University. At the age of 32, he's already recorded 9 albums under his own name, and most of 10 albums. Most of them are either on Indian Navigation or contemporary records, and we'll be hearing selections from several of his records this afternoon. I want to welcome you to Fresh Air. And there's a quote I want to read you and see what you think of this. This is from Amiri Baraka's liner notes to your album The Outside Within, and here we go. He writes, "What's so interesting about Chico's music, and it is very evident on this album, in fact he's given a title to the album that could sum up the attraction of his music, is that Chico has found a way to be clearly melodic and musically swinging, yet searching, daring, and experimental. In some cases, people think that to swing and be melodic, one has to bathe in cliches. On the other hand, there are folks who think to be modern or serious, one has to be dull. There's even a small group of assimilados who believe that for the music to be really way out, it has to be a dead appendage of European concert music." Well, Chico Freeman, do you think that's true, that a lot of jazz musicians or listeners think that to be really far out, you have to be a dead appendage of European music? What's he getting at, and what do you think?
Well, I don't know if he means exactly that you think you have to be, but they probably do think that they are.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. That's right. Yeah. I know a lot of musicians, one of whom you've played and recorded with, Anthony Davis, has been accused of being too European. Do you think that that's true, and that he and other musicians are getting too absorbed in European melody or harmony?
Well, that's a touchy subject. It's hard for me to say whether I think that what they are doing is getting too involved in European, you know, harmonies. This music, I think, you know, its roots come from both African roots as well as European, you know, European roots. It's a kind of a combination of the two. That's what I think actually makes it unique to any other music in the world, is the unique combination that it has, you know, which is what I think is, you know, the African American classical music. So in that regard, it's hard for me to say that Anthony or some other musicians are moving too much in that. If they are not sincerely doing that, then I would say maybe so. But I know Anthony, so I know that he's a very sincere musician and honest musician, and he's experimenting in the works that he's doing. And that just happens to be the way he hears and what he comes up with.
What do you see as being the conservative and the radical impulses in jazz now?
That's hard. I don't know. I suppose what's conservative is what has been, and people will try to maintain the status quo, or, you know, that's the status of what has been. The only thing I would consider conservative really is the closed-mindedness of people to accept anything other than that which they are familiar with, you know. And so radical, I don't know, I think, to separate them quite like that would, I don't think, necessarily be accurate, because like the title of my new album, which is coming out on Elektra, the title of it is Tradition in Transition. And I think that as long as this music exists, which I think will be as long as there are people, that the music is in transition constantly. And it's the tradition, which yesterday's avant-garde is today's tradition. And it's continually moving, and the music is continually developing and changing and growing.
Well, there's a number of musicians now and who are recording, say, Jelly Roll Morton pieces, or, you know, the repertoire of early jazz. And I wonder if there was a time when you were first listening to music when you were very young, if any of that music was maybe embarrassing almost, or something that you wouldn't really listen to because it was old fashioned.
No, not in my particular case. The only music I can remember not particularly listen to was Dixieland, And then I later found out, and when I say Dixieland, because it was people like Al Hurd that I wasn't particularly interested in at that time. As a young musician, I thought it was old, you know. But that was until I realized and found out that Al Hurd really wasn't playing Dixieland, that there was a New Orleans style of music, which didn't get much attention or recognition. And when I first heard those, and the musicians who never got much recognition, but they were playing actually the original form of the music, and I found it to be much superior to the commercially purported kind of music, you know, that they call Dixieland. And when I heard that, I found a lot in it. And, of course, at that time, I began to search out other forms of music. Because I studied Jelly Roll Morton and Scott Joplin and the people that played ragtime and music like that, even people like Willie the Lion Smith and those musicians, long before it became fashionable. I mean, when I first met Richard Abrams, Mujah Richard Abrams, we were involved in those kinds of studies, and that was long before the movie The Sting came out, which was what really brought, you know, the music of Scott Joplin to the public again.
A lot of your earlier titles, song titles, have pretty spiritual connotations to it. Where does that come from for you? Is it like an organized religion, spiritual reference, or something different than that?
No, I'm not organized as far as religion is concerned. My titles are very important to me. The reason that I choose titles, well, let's put it this way: when you listen to music with lyrics, you don't really have to use your imagination, because basically the lyrics do speak and set up your images for you. When you listen to improvisational music or instrumental music where there aren't any really lyrics, the music in and of itself, when you listen to it, can suggest many different kinds of images to different people. I think that's one of the beautiful things about the music, is that, 15 or 1,000 or a million people can listen to the same piece and have very different images with, that come to it. But yet, I think that probably one of the only ways that the listener can get a truer reading of the artist in terms of his concept, or of the piece, or in my case, sometimes the concept of the album, as not necessarily the album as a sound recording with individual compositions on it, but more or less that, a sound recording conceptual, with the whole thing being a total conceptual idea. So therefore, the titles are very important to me in that respect, because I try to project my feelings or, the idea, around the music and the album through those titles.
It's interesting to me that so many jazz musicians are projecting now spiritual thoughts in their titles and in the music as well, since, jazz has been associated with a much more rebellious kind of life, and with good times and dancing, as well as with serious music and composition. But there seems to be a kind of conscious effort to add that spiritual component and to leave that association with rebelliousness and with alcohol and jive titles and things like that.
Well, when you look at the history of jazz, and I think to me jazz is synonymous, it's equal to African-American classical music, which I think is important to note. When you look at the history, early in the history of jazz, musicians were basically forced to play in, the places, the brothels and the, the place in the nightlife. It was basically forced into that because of the circumstances in society at that time. Since then, I don't know that this is a new movement when you speak about spiritual titles. As much, because I know Duke Ellington had many, many, titles where he even wrote sacred concerts and, many things. And there were other musicians, too, that dealt with that. So I don't think it's something that's very new. And musicians, even though stereotyped, to be, you know, in the world of drugs and alcohol and things like that. That stereotype is not always very accurate as well. Even my father, who I've never known him to drink heavily. You know, he drinks socially, but to drink, you know, to be really the stereotypical kind of musician. That's one of the reasons why I think, you know, him not leaving Chicago was also fits in that, you know, category. So my titles are specifically important to me, and the kinds of titles, some have spiritual reference, others, I think the whole thing is because musicians did have, though there was a raising of consciousness still recently, I think, in terms of the music and the projection of the music, you know, and when the way you wanted to reach people, and also what you as a musician, the artist, were in touch with, and becoming more in touch with yourself and with the creator and this, you know, the world around you and the world without you, but through going inside of yourself, you know.
Chico Freeman is my guest if you're just joining us, and he'll be performing tomorrow afternoon at the Mann Music Center as part of the Cool Jazz Festival. I'd like to play some of one of your compositions. This is called Minstrel's Sundance. And for myself and for nearly everyone I know who listens to it, even people just walking by when we're playing it in the office, everyone thinks of like football.
Football.
It has a real marching band kind of sound to it in the opening. Would you tell us what you were thinking about when you were writing this, and what the title indicates? Also, it's called Minstrel Sundance.
Yes. Well, this piece is actually dedicated to the black minstrels, the minstrels who sang up and down the Mississippi River at the turn of the century, right after slavery. During that time, right after slavery, I guess that would be the Reconstruction period, in after the Civil War. The African Americans, the blacks, were promised a mule, 30 acres and a mule, something like that, which they never got. And so during that time, the musicians or the artists, the only way they made a living or could survive, you know, was to sing and dance and play. And it was like, it was where that whole concept of blackface, you know, like the white guys would, you know, blackface themselves. Well, where they got that idea was from the minstrels who sang on the riverboats, like the Mississippi Riverboat. And these guys used to sing and play banjo and instruments for their dinner, not usually for money, but, you know, for their supper and things like that. And I'm trying to think of the guy. Is it Eddie Cantor? What's the guy that got famous doing that? Eddie Cantor was one of them, but there was another guy.
Al Jolson?
Yeah. Al Jolson, yeah. He got this, you know, the idea of from what they were doing, because he took it, copied it directly from that. And so this song came because of, like, these kind of musicians had a lot of fun, you know, and when they sang and they played, it was real, you say marchy, I don't think of the football game, but I think of, you know, like it was like a circus. Not like a circus, but that kind of carousel kind of feeling, the feeling of, you know what I mean, having a good time in that way. And it was the first time they really had an opportunity, musicians had an opportunity to really perform their music in front of people, you know what I mean, live people, you know, like live audiences and things like that. So that's what this piece, that's where it came from. And since it was mostly done outside and down south, that's why I called the Minstrel Sundance.
Okay, well, let's hear it, and then we'll talk some more. Chico Freeman is my guest, and he's the composer of this piece, Minstrel Sundance, and he's featured on tenor saxophone, along with Jay Hogart on vibes, Cecil McPhee bass, Anthony Davis at the piano, and Famudu Don Moye on drums. From the album Kings of Mali, we heard Chico Freeman's composition Minstrel's Sundance, and Chico Freeman was featured on tenor saxophone with Jay Hogarth on vibes, Cecil McBee bass, Anthony Davis at the piano, and Famudu Danmoye on drums and percussion. And when we started listening to that, I had mentioned that a lot of people I know think of like football marching bands when they hear it. And you weren't thinking of that at all.
No, I really didn't. I think that idea in the beginning just came up probably in the studio, you know, as an introduction to it.
You grew up in Chicago and studied music there and joined the AACM, which is the Association for the Advancement of... Is it Creative Music or Creative Musicians?
Creative Musicians.
And studied with Mule Richard Abrams there. What kind of scene was that at the time when you were first becoming a part of that group?
Fantastic. It was one of the best things that ever happened to me, but... what it was, the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians, was an organization that started, began during a period when most of the club owners and people like that were pretty much against music that wasn't in the traditional, what traditional stood for at the time, you know. If you weren't playing more or less bebop-oriented music, then it was very difficult to work. And musicians don't feel that they should be held back by, you know, people not being able to understand. So musicians got together to form a co-op to basically, in the beginning, to showcase original music. And hence, you know, the organization, the AACM. During that time, of course, you know, what they call the first, what has been referred to as the first generation of AACM people, Anthony Braxton, the art, people in the art ensemble and so forth, Roscoe Mitchell and people like that, got together and along with Moonhall and, you know, produced their own concerts and did the same thing. By that the time I arrived was through a guy by the name of Fred Anderson, who's a member, I was in school at Northwestern University, and he suggested that when I was about to graduate for me to go down and see Moore. And I did, and joined. And at that time I began studying, because the AACM had a school that they were teaching on, had various levels, intermediate, advanced, and so forth, and elementary, which were teaching a lot of the community, you know, the kids in the community, music, and Muha was teaching the advanced theory and composition. So I began studying with him after having graduated from Northwestern with a degree in music, and found a completely different kind of an approach to music, which I found much more stimulating and exciting and challenging. So eventually I began to teach myself in the school, in the ASM school, and then around the time I went to Governor State to work on my master's degree. So the climate then was very, very productive, a lot of creativity going on. Much of the experimenting that I did had its beginning there because of the fact that, in the beginning, because of the musicians who were involved in the organization and the kinds of instrumentation, a lot of instrumentation was, you know, experimentation was going on with different kinds of instrumentation because of what we had to work with. And it continued, and of course, you know, I learned a lot more about Black history in terms of music, you know, Black music history, and not only the music within the realm of jazz, which is African American classical music, not only in that realm, but also a lot of Black composers who composed and wrote in the tradition of European classical music, which a lot of people aren't familiar with, you know, people like Nathaniel Dett and Holly Johnson, people like this who wrote symphonies and things like that, you know, within that tradition. So it was a great learning, a period of learning, and used to play every day, practice every day. There were two big bands happening. There was the AACM big band, and the Muhal had his own, you know, big band, and I played in both. And we worked every weekend, you know, and showcased music, as well as I had my own group, which at the time featured Don Moyer, Malachi Favors, and Bill Brimfield, and I dig okay Steve Colson. And Muhal had his sextet, and, you know, the musicians were doing concerts, and there were a lot of different concerts happening all week long, as well as the school, and as well as, you know, the two big bands. It was very good.
You said that the kind of teaching that went on there was very different from what you'd been used to at the conservatory. Mm-hmm. What's the difference? How did people teach music there?
The conservatory in Northwestern in the music school was very limiting in conceptual ideals. It was basically about learning thoroughly that which had preceded within the confines of European classical music. And, I mean, you know, yeah, they wanted us to write pieces the way Beethoven wrote a piece. You know, write, you study that, to write a piece the way Debussy would use, you know, his period during the Romantic period, everything like that. And it was very close to, you know, new ideas. Even when they gave you, even when things were assigned to you that where you might be able to stretch a little bit. Like I remember once in music history class, we were told to write a piece, to write a biography and analyze a piece of music by any 20th century composer. And to me, the word any 20th century composer means just that, any 20th century composer. And I chose at that time to write about John Coltrane, and some other people chose, some other people went in African-American classical music, but they really didn't anticipate that that would be a choice from some of the students. And it caused some problems during that time because they really anticipated that we would write on somebody like Schoenberg maybe, or, you know, one of the, you know, people like that. But when I got to the AACM and studied with Muhal, we studied everything that they taught in Northwestern. I mean, you know, nothing was helping. But we also found out that there were great African-American musicians in the European tradition, as well as the musicians, I mean, the history. I went all the way back to the blues, to you know, to spirituals, and all the way through the development of African-American classical music, you know, from then up to now. And the devices, the tech devices that were used, and how to use it. And basically, for example, in composition, we were given tools, but then the idea was not for you to copy, but that for you to understand the tools that had been used, for you to understand how that you could use, for how you could understand how that you could use them yourself to, you know, to be original. And, you know, do things in an original way. It was Muhal, I think, who taught me that I was only limited by my own imagination. So that was the kind of environment. So it was very stimulating, and you know, the idea of many, many things. I learned many, many things in terms of composition that actually affected my way of playing. Systems that I've developed. I've developed maybe 4, 5, 6 different systems myself.
What kind in of addition, systems?
Well, that'd be
hard
to describe. Yeah, you know, but. Developing these systems, which I use, you know, in my writing as well as in my playing it from time to time for different things. And
what do you give musicians when you've written a composition like the last piece that we just heard, which seems like it would be pretty hard to get down on paper?
Well, it depends on what I want to achieve in the composition. But if it's for ensemble parts, you know, sometimes music is written. Other times I use other kinds of cymbals, depending on, you know, what I want to do. And I always try to choose the best musicians so that the most creative kinds of musicians who can interpret things and, you know, project so that their personality comes through.
I want to get back to some more of your music, and let me introduce you first, again, for our listeners just joining us. Chico Freeman is my guest. He's a tenor saxophonist and composer, and will be on the bill tomorrow afternoon at the Cool Jazz Festival. His most recent album is called Destiny's Dance, and we're listening to selections from several of his albums this afternoon. This is not one of your compositions. Most of the things we're hearing today are things that you've written, but this is a standard in the jazz and pop repertoire, Autumn in New York, and we'll hear a duet between you and Cecil McBee on bass. You don't play too many standards. You mostly play your own compositions. Would you tell us why you chose to do mostly standards on this record, Spirit Sensitive, and several ballads as well?
Well, it was basically intended to be an album of ballads because I like to play ballads. One thing, I was suggested that I did them very well. Bob Cummins of Indian Navigation had said that to me once, and he said he thought that I did it well. It would be interesting, you know. And I like ballads, and I thought that I play standards too. I don't do it so much as in public performances all the time because I write and I'm a composer, and I, you know, try to do that. But I spend a lot of time playing standards and you know, going through the tradition of the music. Like I said, I studied all the music, so that's part of the tradition. So I decided when we got the idea to do the album of ballads, we knew that it would be very important in the kinds of ballads we chose, the kind of material, you know. So I decided not to choose the kind of ballads that was basically expected of you to play in the sense that it's part of the tradition, you know, the usual vows. We wanted to play some things that were not recorded much, and more importantly, music that I really personally felt close to or liked, you know, rather than doing a tune because it was, you know, it's one of the standards that you do. So some of these standards are not as well known in terms of standards as standards go, like Horace Silver's Peace and A Child is Born by Thad Jones. But Autumn in New York was one of the first standards that I had learned a long time when I first started playing. I actually learned it on trumpet, so.
Really?
Yeah. So it was something I'd been playing for a while, and I liked it. And to do it differently, we decided to do it as a duet.
Okay, well, let's hear it. My guest Chico Freeman is featured on tenor saxophone, and this is from his album, Spirit Sensitive. We'll hear Autumn in New York. Thank you. Cecil McBee and Chico Freeman from the Spirit Sensitive album that was Autumn in New York. Chico Freeman is my guest, and he'll be performing tomorrow afternoon on the bill of the Cool Jazz Festival. Let's talk a little bit about how you first started playing. You mentioned before you first learned this on trumpet, so I guess tenor might not have been the first instrument you played. But your father played tenor. When you started playing tenor, was there any awkwardness there since that was his instrument also?
No. I started on piano and then added trumpet and then changed from trumpet to tenor. And when I decided to change to tenor, it was more or less by accident, in a way, I think. I don't really believe it was by accident, but it wasn't really planned that way. I was playing trumpet, and it was in Northwestern, as I remember. And I picked up an alto saxophone and in a class and played it, and it came quickly, just naturally. So I took a tenor home during this break and played it every day and just fell in love with it, and it just happened. It just grew quickly on it, you know. So when it happened, it was very natural, and it touched me in a place where I felt I could really express myself the way I was looking for, the way I was striving to on the trumpet. I could do it much better on the saxophone naturally. And so I just, you know, that's what it was. I didn't really think about my father playing tenor and what that meant in relationship to me. It didn't mean anything. It just meant that I wanted to play the saxophone.
Did you, like, stay home and play and practice when other friends were maybe out playing ball or
socializing? I practiced on an average of 8 to 10 hours a day, every day.
Yeah, you kids who are musicians, I think, get cut off in a way because you have to work so hard to
yeah, you do have to work hard.
Develop it.
I didn't get cut off. Well, it was because it was two things. I thought maybe I wanted to be a professional basketball player at one time. So,
no kidding.
So, you know, that was a difficult decision because I love basketball. But for a while there, I was playing 8 hours a day on the saxophone, and the rest of the time I was spending playing basketball. So I did get a chance to play ball, but I did work very hard on music.
I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but sometimes in your family, it's like hard for someone in your family to teach you, for instance, how to drive a car, because all the emotional tensions from the family start coming up. You know, like step on the brakes, you're get us into an accident, and just all the stuff that goes into the craziness of any kind of family relationship comes out in the teaching of how to drive. Was there any of that when you were learning tenor, since I'm sure your father would have lots of suggestions about how to play?
Yeah, there was some of that. Sure. My father's so great at what he does that he has patience in the beginning. He was fairly patient. That's why I really didn't study with him much in the beginning. But when I did come to him and do some things, if I didn't do something right, which came natural to him, you know, he sometimes had his patience ran a little short sometimes. Not often.
Jazz is such a personal music, since there's no such thing as the correct tone or even the correct note if you're improvising.
No, but there are certain things that are correct, you know, in music that, you know, that you have to be aware of. And he wasn't terrible about it, I have to say. But there were times, you know, and I think it had to do with the fact that we were so close.
Did you play together?
Yeah, we do. We did, and we still do. In fact, we're touring Europe this summer together.
Together?
We've already done two or three European tours, and this will be another one that we're doing and together.
Do you hang out a lot together when you're touring together?
We play a lot in the bandstand and travel a lot. Yeah, because I'm always trying to find out what he knows.
about music or other stuff?
Of course, no, about music. No. Yeah,
you've obviously been influenced to some degree by Coltrane. Although, I mean, there are some people who spend their musical careers imitating Coltrane, and that's certainly not descriptive of you. But how do you find your own voice? I mean, you have the people who've influenced you and who I imagine you, like, really, particularly when you're young, try to sound like. But how do you develop your own voice? Is it like a speaking voice where you basically, like, have your tone and that's it, or did you actually like have something in your mind that you wanted to achieve and create a tone for yourself?
Well, generally, you try to sound like somebody, but I never did. And fortunately, that was because of my father. That was one thing he taught me. And
he taught you not to try to sound like someone else?
Right. No, because he said, you know, you never get anywhere doing that. I mean, what good is it? In fact, he used to tell me about back, you know, early with early musicians, they didn't do that anyway. They didn't want to do that. They used to do when they found that they sounded like anything like someone, they would do something different just so they wouldn't. They were always individuals, and that's what they were. It was only more, I guess, with the recorded music becoming more prevalent, you know what I mean, and the industry becoming more sophisticated, that younger musicians could buy records and hear it and then sit home and try to copy. They did copy solos then, you know, of musicians, but to actually sit down and just try to sound, you know, get the sound and the notes and all the nuances like some of the younger musicians do, wasn't the way that they did. And he taught me that early, and said that the best way would always be to find my own voice. And you have to learn to accept your own voice, because you always think that you should sound like someone else. You hear in your ear, because what you hear, you don't hear yourself. You know, you hear other people, you hear records, and you hear what you like, the way other people sound. So then when you listen, and when you start to sound, your sound is foreign to you. And so sometimes most of the time you don't like it, because you just think, you always think someone else is better. But if you just work at the things that are going to make you have a better sound, just in terms, you know, developing your embouchure, practicing your long time, you know, those kinds of things, you develop your own sound. That's what I did. I just tried to develop the sound that I have naturally. That's because that's, anytime you can be yourself, you know, you'll always have peace of mind, and you know, that's in anything, in relationships or anything. And there's definitely a relationship between, you know, a musician and his music.
Do you remember the first time you listened back to a tape of yourself playing?
Oh, yeah. What? I remember many times, even today.
Is it scary listening back even today?
Well, I don't know if it was. I was always dissatisfied with what I heard, and I still am, usually. When I first started recording, that was traumatic.
So how do you deal with that? Do you listen more to get used to it?
No, I listen less.
Really?
I go through periods. You go through periods where when I first record something, I listen to it, and I usually try to get some space from it because I'm too biased in the beginning. I'm very hard on myself. I'm probably my worst critic. I am my worst. I really am hard on myself. And I said, like, oh, you should have done this. You could have done that. You know, you didn't do this. Go practice some more. You need to practice. You should stop playing and just go practice, you know, things like that. So what I do is I know I'm going to tell myself I should have practiced more. I should do more practicing. So instead, I won't listen. I just go practice right away, you know, and practice until I get the whole thing out of my head. Then I come back to it and listen. And it usually sounds fresh, and it's not as disturbing. It's actually, sometimes it's pleasing. At least it's the criticism is more constructive, I think, because I still may have the things, you know, some criticisms of it, but more from a little different, you know, from being further away from it. I said, that was a good idea I did there, but next time I'll do it this way, or I'll try to practice. It's a little bit easier on myself.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking about your composing and also your tenor playing, but I've neglected to mention so far your bass clarinet playing, and we're going to hear a sample of that now. When did you start playing bass clarinet?
Not long after I started playing the tenor.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Not too long after that, maybe a couple of years or so after. So I've been playing it for a while.
How do you know which you're going to use for a piece?
It depends. Like I said, I've developed certain systems, not only for playing, but for writing.
The systems too complicated to describe.
It depends on a lot of things. Creativity, sometimes creativity comes and I don't know what I'm going to do or how it's going to work out. Sometimes I'll write a piece and play it and I'll try it and I find that I think I like it better on the bass clarinet than I do on something else. Or, you know.
But do you want to tell us about this piece? We're going to hear The Search.
The Search. It's basically about that. An original title for it was The Search from Oneself, and it's about searching, you know, the life, the thing, that which we spend all our lives doing, trying to find out who we are. The smarter ones of us, I think, try to do that, but try to you know, the search of who we are and the understanding of self, you know, the search from self. And in searching that way, I think you end up searching, you know, everything is contained. And, you know, they say we are the manifestation of the universe. So, you know, all of the universe is contained within our bodies, spirits, and souls. And so it's about the search from within, which is also the search from without, you know, the whole thing. And it's a very serious piece, I think.
But
beautiful, because I think it's beautiful to do that.
Let's listen to this piece. It's called The Search, and my guest Chico Freeman, this time featured on bass clarinet, along with Cecil McBay on bass, John Hicks piano, and Jack DeJohnette drums. Chico Freeman featured on tenor saxophone and bass clarinet, and we heard a piece called The Search from his album The Outside Within. And along with him, we heard Jack the Jeanette on drums, Cecil McBee on bass, John Hicks at the piano. Chico Freeman will be performing on the bill tomorrow afternoon at the Mann Music Center as part of the Cool Jazz Festival. We were talking a few minutes ago about your father and growing up in Chicago, and he never really left Chicago to go to one of the music centers like New York or Los Angeles. And you obviously did. You left to go to New York. Did his obscurity to everyone except people who really know a lot about jazz make you especially want to leave and find the music center and become known?
No.
Okay.
I came to New York, this truly by accident.
Really?
Yes. I was getting my master's degree in the band. I was in the jazz band at Governor State. And we competed in the Notre Dame Jazz Festival. And we won almost all the awards that year. And I won two of them. And as a result of that, we were chosen to go to Brazil, South America. I don't know, it's some kind of special exchange program. And on the way, I stopped in New York because you had to. And on the way back, since I had a ticket back to Chicago and everything, I thought, why not spend 3 days in New York? Air was playing in New York. They were supposed to hit at the East. And a friend of mine that I had gone to school with was living there. So I said I'd go stop and see him and, you know, and see Air and then come on back. As it turned out, Air's gig was canceled and Henry Threadgill wanted to go back to Chicago, and he had a gig with a singer by the name of Gene Lee, and he asked me if I would take the gig so he could go back to Chicago. So I said, all right, that meant I'd have to stay longer, so I did, I took the gig, and that weekend we played, and it did so well, they extended her to the next week, so my 3 days turned from a week to 2 weeks, and in the meantime, I sat in with Mickey Bass, and, you know, he hired me then to do a tribute to trumpet players, a concert that was done up at Camby Hall with tribute to it was Clifford Brown, Booker Little, Kenny Durham, and Fats Navarro. And after that, he hired me to play. He was working every Sunday in a club for like a month or two. So anyway, that then turned into my 3 days turned into a month. In the meantime, I sat in with Cecil McBee, which began our relationship. And when John Stubblefield, who was playing tenor with him, got an offer to go with Nat Adderley, I joined Cecil's band, and I was just in New York, and I just ended up staying in New York. I never went back.
Oh, we don't have much time left, but how would you describe the jazz scene in New York now? Are there lots of
gigs? A lot of clubs.
And,
mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a lot of clubs. It's hitting. There's a lot of music in New York now, a lot.
There are different circles of musicians, like the Chicago musicians? And
not so much anymore. At least, you know, when we first came, it was like that. But now, a lot of, you know, it's just a lot of music now.
You have a new record that will be coming out soon on Elektra, and this will be your first album. Mm-hmm. That label, what can we look forward to hearing on that?
Well, the title of the album is Tradition in Transition, and that goes by with what I was speaking of, the music continually growing. It features Cecil McBee, Jack DeJeanette on piano and drums, Billy Hart on drums, Clyde Craner on piano, and Wallace Roney, a new ethnic somebody you're going to be hearing a lot from, a trumpet player. This band, actually, we'll be performing with this band at Cool this year, with the exception of Jack. And it's a lot of good music on there, I think. I'm particularly proud of the compositional aspects of it, some very different kinds of compositions, and I think some real beautiful compositions as well as some very different, fresh kinds of things. So it'll be released in August.
Just curious, in order for people to know an album, it has to get played on the radio to some degree, and there aren't mm-hmm. that many jazz stations, but there are some. Do you compose at all with an ear for what can get radio play, or at least record that composition with an ear for that?
Sometimes. Not necessarily for... I don't try to compromise my music for that purpose, but sometimes I will pay attention to the time,
mm-hmm.
because I understand the radio, you know, sometimes if it's too long, sometimes not. It really depends on the compositions, but sometimes I do try to do that.
Well, I wish you success with your new record, and I want to thank you a lot for talking with us about your music and your life. Thanks for being here, Chico Freeman.